So this is the second machine talk after Robert Edwards' talk yesterday, and no, he's not here. So ah, there he is. Ah, yeah, okay. Yeah. So that was a really nice talk, and you know, it left us with the impression that clusters are really, really fast and affordable now, and so we are under a lot of pressure to make the case for custom-built machines, of course, as compared to clusters. And this is the point I'm going to try to make in this talk. And since QCDOC was built or developed and built together with IBM, this is also the right place to thank IBM for a substantial amount of sponsorship of this conference, and the fundraising was done by John. So let me also
and
Gian Bano and Pavlos and Pavlos as well. Yeah. So as some of you know, I recently moved back to Germany, and people keep asking me what this place Regensburg is. So let me just briefly show you where it is on the map. This is the state of Bavaria in Germany. This is Munich, and it's about a little more than an hour north of Munich. Okay, unless, like some of my friends, you're working for BMW and have a company car, then it's substantially faster. And for those of you that know German or that don't know German, Regen means rain in German, and so you might think it rains a lot, but it's actually not true. There's a river here called Regen, which flows into the Danube, and that's why it's called Regensburg. Yeah. And so it's on the Danube. It's actually the northernmost point of the Danube, and this is sort of how it looks like. Nice old town. And this is a famous stone bridge, the oldest one in Germany, which took 12 years to build, from 1135 to 1146. And so I'm proud to report that it took less than 12 years to finish QCDOC, only like 4 years or so, right?
That's a lot smaller than that.
We could have a
laugh. I'm afraid at some point we will. Yeah. Sorry? This has been under construction ever since I first set foot in Regensburg. So, yeah. Actually, I live on the other side of the bridge. Yeah, so it's I look out on this side. So this is downloaded from the web. I didn't take that picture myself, but there's some nice beer gardens right here. It's probably taken from the beer garden. Okay, so let me start. And of course, I don't need to give an introduction to Lattice QCD, so let me jump right into the problem. So it's clear to everyone that we have to do dynamical fermion simulations, and they're extremely expensive. And there is some rough estimate by the European Committee for Future Accelerators how expensive the simulations really are as a function of the physical volume, the lattice spacing, and the mass of the lightest superscalar particle. And there are powers here. There's a large, very large power here. There's a large inverse power here. We want to take these three limits, and of course, this gets extremely expensive. Cost in floating point operations. Okay? Okay. So this is for dynamical Wilson fermions, unimproved. Staggered fermions, of course, are somewhat cheaper than that. And chiral fermions are a lot more expensive, and people typically use a factor of 100 or so. This is just ballpark. Okay? And so in this high-performance computing industry, they have a number of grand challenge problems, and lattice QCD is one of them. And we've heard a lot during this conference about various ways to get a better analytical understanding of these limits, chiral extrapolations, improvement, finite volume calculations, and so on. We heard talks about better algorithms. All of this, of course, helps a lot. But it's nice to have bigger and better computers. They get faster by the minute. So of course, one should take advantage of that. And if one can do something to design, a computer that is most suited for this, for the problem at hand, then of course, it's what one should think about it, whether this is economical. Okay. So if you do a large simulation, then of course you work on a big parallel machine where you distribute your global volume over many processors, and this is just a very simple example of that, where the global volume is 16 by 16 in two dimensions, and so you distribute this over four processors arranged in a 2x2 grid, so that you, so the local volume associated with a single processor is 8x8, and then you have to communicate between neighboring processors, typically in a torus topology, so with periodic boundary conditions in each dimension. And so on this slide, I've tried to summarize what the important issues are in parallel computing in lattice QCD, because we know what our, where most of our flops go, namely into the inversion of the fermion matrix. And this is typically done using a CG algorithm, which has two important ingredients, matrix vector multiplication and scalar products, so global summations. Okay, so you wanted a, you want a machine that can perform these two operations very efficiently, you know, if you have a large number of processors. So if you now go to a parallel machine, then we always have to communicate between processors, and that, of course, slows down the calculation. That is just wasting time, right? So on, there are two main factors that contribute to this waste, let's say. One is the bandwidth, how many bits you can communicate per unit time, and the communication latency, which is sort of the startup time it takes to send a message. And what we are typically interested in lattice QCD is a certain fixed physical volume, and then we distribute this physical volume, this global volume, over as many processes as we can layer our hands on. And that means that the local volume that's associated with a single processor becomes small. And in this HPC industry, this problem is called hard scaling. Okay? And if your local volume becomes small, then of course the surface to volume ratio becomes large. And the amount of communication you have to do is typically proportional to the surface. The amount of computation is typically proportional to the volume. And so your machine becomes very inefficient. And in that case, in this hard scaling case, it's really the latency that dominates your performance and not the bandwidth. Bandwidth is always cheap. You can always add more wires and more pins, but latency involves the speed of light and things like that. So that is hard. And ideally, of course, what you want to do is to overlap communication and computation. This is called communication latency hiding in computer science. And if you can do that, of course, then you don't care so much about latency and bandwidth. But of course, this cannot always be done perfectly. And so how well you have dealt with this problem can be, you know, characterized by a single number called the sustained performance. So this is the percentage of peak that you get. And this is what Robert pointed out yesterday. This is really all you care about, the sustained performance you get. He also said you don't care about peak, but I wouldn't quite phrase it that way, because peak is typically given to you, and then you're trying to get as much, you know, sustained performance out of it as you can. So typically you try to increase that percentage that you can get. Right? And now you measure this this percentage, this sustained performance, as a function of either the local volume or the number of processors. And so scalability is then the curve of how this sustained performance, this percentage, scales with the number of processors. And typical architectures, that goes down drastically. And here's an experiment done by Peter Boyle a number of years ago. This was an alpha cluster with a Marionette interconnect, where this here is the local volume, this axis. So the number of processors increases in this direction. And the black line here is just a single CPU. So the performance goes up as the local volume becomes smaller, because at some point it fits into the on-chip memory. And so that's not surprising. And then there are three different ways of doing the communication, all, of course, across Marionette. But this is using MPI, the green curve. The other two curves are using Marionette's own communication routines, which are better than MPI. And the red line is a one-dimensional topology of your network, and the blue line is a two-dimensional topology. And you see that as the local volume becomes small, so as the surface-to-volume ratio becomes large, your performance drops like a rock. And you also see that it doesn't matter whether it's a one- or two-dimensional topology, Yeah. So, and even though this two-dimensional grid has twice the bandwidth, you get the same performance, so that tells you that it's all dominated by latency and not by bandwidth. Okay, so let me just look at the three options that we have for large computers. So PC clusters, of course, have been discussed extensively yesterday by Robert. By now, they're very cost-effective. They're relatively easy to build. They are useful for all kinds of different applications. And I would also like to point out that if you just want to experiment on a problem, then, of course, that's great. Right? So you don't need a large machine to do that. For many, many people, for many groups, this is the ideal choice. However, if you really want to go to very large numbers of processors, you really want to beat a problem to death, right, and you know exactly what you want to do, what kind of algorithms you're going to use, and so on, then this is not the most, not the best choice, because they just don't scale well to these large numbers. And then you could, of course, go ahead and buy a commercial supercomputer from IBM Cray, SGI, whatnot. But they tend to be very expensive, something like a factor of 10 more expensive than machines like QCDOC or ARPA. And they, of course, want to make a profit, so they aim their machines at the general purpose market. So typically, they're not as efficient at QCD simulations as our custom-built machines. And also, they are run in SMP mode. So you have typically there are clusters of SMPs, and these SMP nodes are connected by switches. So that also doesn't scale well to, at least this hard scaling doesn't work well on such machines. Sometimes they have, you know, when they have more nodes, they add a two or three dimensional network, but they are often underpowered when you really look at them. And if they are crossbar, then of course they also don't scale to large numbers of processors. So in many of these machines, you can't really go to 10,000 processors anyway, with a few notable exceptions, mainly BlueGNL, of course, and to some extent probably also the Cray XT3, not the X1, but the XT3, and there may be others that I don't know about. Okay, now, if you give up the general purpose market, if you really concentrate on a single problem, then you can beat these machines, yeah, because you know what the characteristics of your problem are, and you can address them in hardware. And there's an extreme example for that. That's the great machine in Japan, yeah, for astrophysical, that basically n-body problem, where the calculation that they do is encoded on the chip. They get huge floating point performance on a single chip. Yeah. So this is extreme special. Sorry? I see. Yeah. So for lattice QCD, you know, we know ahead of time, you know, when we need data from memories, so we can prefetch them. We have mainly nearest neighbor communications, and we know exactly how these communications are going to proceed, and it's always the same. So we can design our hardware to take this into account, and then get better scalability out of such machines. Okay, so QCDOC, well, most of you know that, but let me just summarize. It's a successor to the earlier QCDSP project. And of course, there have been even earlier Columbia machines. And it's a collaboration with IBM Research at Yorktown, then, of course, Columbia University, the RIKEN BNL Research Center, UK QCD, and the SciDEC initiative. And it's based on a so-called ASIC. That's an application-specific integrated circuit, and I'll show pictures later on. And as I just explained, we've optimized it for the communications requirements of lattice QCD. And as we'll see, it's really scalable to a large number of nodes, so tens of thousands, and you still can get a sustained performance of almost 50%, even if the local volume is very small. We still, even though the project was delayed a little bit, so it arrived a little later than expected, we still have the best price performance ratio of all those machines. And what's very important and is sometimes overlooked is that it's very low power consumption, and therefore you don't have any serious cooling issues. And one advantage we have over the other project, which is ARPANEXT, is that we have a more or less standard software environment. I'll discuss this in a little more detail later. But of course, ARPANEXT is also a great machine. designed by the Italians, Daisy, and some French participation. So there's a long line of these machines, and you all know about them, and I'm not going to discuss them in this talk. Okay, so these are the people that have participated in the design. Of course, the lead is by Norman Crist, and a number of postdocs and graduate students, and Borgner Winnie as well, at Columbia. So probably the most important graduate student was Gofeng Liu, who is now at Wall Street, unfortunately. And and then Azusa Yamaguchi, who is now in Scotland, at Glasgow/Edinburgh. The most important contact man we have at IBM is Alan Guerra, who is also a theoretical physicist by training, then became an experimentalist and is now at IBM. He's just amazing. He knows everything. He's extremely smart, and whenever you have a problem, you just ask him, and he most likely he'll know it. Dong Chen, of course, is a former Lattice physicist that many of you might know, and these are engineers at IBM. So then there's the Riken BNL Center, so Shigemi Ota, and I was a fellow there when I was still at Yale, and now I moved to Regensburg. Then there is, of course, UKQCD, Peter Boyle, who was and is extremely important to this project, who wrote most of the software and is generally, right now, unfortunately, I mean, he should have been here, but he seems to be chained to the machine in Edinburgh, so they didn't let him go. So it's, yeah. Mike is here, back there, and Balint has already been mentioned in Tony's and Robert's talks. And then the SIDEC involvement is Cho Wu-Chang is a postdoc at Columbia, and Kostya Petrov is a postdoc still at Brookhaven/Columbia, who wrote a lot of the software. Okay. This is a plot I just downloaded from the BlueGene website, which puts QCDOC sort of on the map of, you know, general purpose and special purpose machines, and this is BlueGene up here. And let me just, before I really describe the hardware, let me just summarize how many nodes there are now at the various places. So there's a big machine at Edinburgh, a big one at the RBRC, another, they're almost the same size, all of them. The OE machine is still being assembled, but parts of it are already running. There's a somewhat smaller Columbia machine and a tiny Regensburg machine, which will be arriving tomorrow at the university. It's still sitting at the airport in customs, but I have been assured that it will be there tomorrow. So when I come home on Sunday, I can start working on it. Okay, and so this is really going to be the workhorse for Lattice QCD, both in the US and in the UK for the, let's say, the next 5 years or so. Okay, so now let me come to the architecture. This is, so in this lingo of computer science, this is called a MIMD machine, run in SPMD mode. So this is multiple instruction, multiple data, single program, and multiple data. No shared memory, the memory is distributed. QCDOC stands for QCD on a chip, because this is a so-called system on a chip design, where you put everything that is normally on your motherboard on a single chip. This QCDOC ASIC, where you have lots of, you know, standard IBM components, like standard CPU, the so-called 440 PowerPC 440 core, a double precision floating point unit, 4 megabyte on-chip memory, and then we designed our own high-performance memory controller for this on-chip memory, and of course the entire communications hardware, all on the chip. Then, in addition to this physics communications hardware, there's a separate Ethernet network and another global tree network, and I'll explain them later. The price-performance ratio is less than $1 per sustained megaflops, and this I already mentioned. The chip consumes typically 5 watts, and there are then a few more watts for the memory. And this is this picture was already shown yesterday. This is the ASIC. Here's the CPU, the FPU, the embedded memory, the memory controller for external DDR memory. This is the so-called processor local bus, which is the analog of the frontside bus of your Pentium 4. This is the on-chip peripheral bus, which is the analog of the PCI bus on your motherboard, which, you know, has some slower components like the Ethernet controller. And this is the communications hardware, which I describe in more detail later on. there's a really cool little feature here called the Ethernet JTAG interface. This is a little device on the chip that converts special UDP packets into so-called JTAG commands. JTAG is a protocol, very simple protocol, by which you can control your CPU and do with it whatever you want, right? And we are using this first to boot the machine so that you don't need any boot prompts. And you know, if you want to change your boot code, you can just do it in software and then just download it over Ethernet. So that's a very convenient, comfortable way to boot the machine. And then we can also use it for debugging. If something ever goes wrong, the thing hangs, you can always get in through JTAG. And another funny story is this low alpha LED. I may have told this to somebody, but if you have such a big machine with so many processors very close to each other, you're of course susceptible to cosmic background radiation. So if some alpha particle hits you, you know, it flips a bit and it's not ECC protected, then you know, you might have a problem. It may not be a problem, but it could be, right? And if you just calculate the rate, it's actually pretty high. Yeah? On your single PC, it doesn't happen very often, but you know, if you have 10,000 processors in a small volume, then it becomes a problem. And so this chip is put in a package, and then the pins are connected to this package, and then the external pins, and you need LED in there somehow. Yeah? Don't ask me why. And it's very important that this LED doesn't emit alpha particles, yeah? That you know, might destroy bits in your registers on the chip, right? So if you pay extra, you can get this low alpha LED. And the funny story is that the best and cheapest source of this low alpha LED is sunken battleships in the Mediterranean. So they send divers down there and get this LED that has been mined a long, long time ago, you know, hundreds of years ago, 100, 200 years ago, but all the unstable isotopes have already decayed, right? And they get this out of it. It's much cheaper than actually separating the isotopes, in some device. Yeah. And so this is how it actually looks like. This was the original floor plan. This is actually how it worked out. So you see that most of the surface of the chip, or most of the area, is taken by the embedded memory. Yeah? It's like almost 3/4 of the chip is the embedded memory. So that limits the amount of memory you can put on the chip. This is the CPU and the attached FPU. And everything else is sort of somewhere in between. I probably shouldn't say too much about the CPU. This is a standard CPU, very similar to what you have in an Apple computer, Macintosh computer. So let me skip that. The networks are a bit more interesting. So I already mentioned there are three different networks. The important one, of course, is the network that is used for physics communications. The topology is a six-dimensional torus with connections between nearest neighbors in all of these six dimensions. And of course, the problem is four or five dimensional, depending on your formulation. And the extra dimension or dimensions allow you to partition the machine in software without having to, unplug cables. You just deactivate some of the links and carve out lower dimensional partitions. The communication is done by low voltage differential signals on serial links using these high-speed serial link transceivers that are part of the IBM ASIC library. And if the chip is run at 500 megahertz, then for a single link, you have a bandwidth of 500 megabits per second. And you have send and receive, so that's a gigabit. And then in six dimensions, you have 12 nearest neighbors. So together, you have a total bandwidth of 12 gigabits per second per node. And all of this is managed by this serial communications unit that was designed at Columbia, a CU, that runs all of these 12 or 24 links concurrently. It has DMA capability, so it can directly access the memory. We have our own custom communications protocol, which detects single bit errors and will do an automatic resend in that case. And what I'm going to describe in more detail in a few minutes is this pass-through mode that greatly accelerates global flums. And then there are some partition interrupts and barriers for synchronization and so on. And the important thing to remember is that our communications performance, both in terms of latency and bandwidth, is roughly comparable to the memory performance. Yeah. So that is the important point to remember. Then there is a just some global tree network for global interrupts that you may or may not need, depending on what you want to do. And then there is an Ethernet network through which you boot the machine, do I/O to files, to disks, and download the operating system, and so on. Single bit error detection, not correction. If you detect one, you resend. I don't think so, because we have an 8-bit header, and which has all kinds of other information in it as well, right? I'm not sure if we can. I think we can only detect single bit errors. I didn't write that protocol, so I don't. But I can find that out, of course. Do you remember that, Tony?
No. Part of the problem we're currently having is that there were double bit errors which cannot be detected.
I thought it was on the memory interface, not on the network interface. I'm pretty sure, actually. So this is just in a picture of what I just described. So the blue thing here is supposed to be a motherboard with, and then there are 64 chips on it, and they're sort of the way they are switched together in Ethernet is in groups of 8, and then they go to some switches with network attached storage, possibly, and then to a host machine with a number of gigabit Ethernet cards. Let me not discuss the SCU because that would take too long, but what I'd like to discuss is this pass-through unit that is on the chip and the way we do global sums, because that's important. So you want to do a global sum over the machine, and this here is a one-dimensional example, because it's difficult to draw, of course, in higher dimensions. And so you have n nodes in this one dimension, and each node has computed a number, and now you want to sum all these numbers and make the result known to all the nodes. Right? That's the problem. And so each node would send its the result it has computed to its nearest neighbor. So in this case, this node sends to this guy. He receives it, and then there is some smart logic in hardware here, which identifies something in the header that says this is a global sum. And so it receives that number, but at the same time passes it through to the send unit, and immediately, with extremely low latency, passes it on to the next guy. Okay, and so that's what's written here. And then, of course, it also puts this number in its own memory. And after you've done this n minus one times, you have received the numbers from all the guys, from all the other n minus one guys in that dimension. You can add them up, and you don't need to broadcast the result because everyone has the result. Right? And the point here is that the latency. That's right. Yeah, because you have all the numbers from all the other guys. Okay. Each one of them. Why? This is all IEEE, so why would you? If you have the same numbers. Okay, you're right. Okay. I don't know how this is solved. Actually, I don't know. One could. I don't know. This is double precision. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But yeah, it's the issue is still there. Yeah. So okay, I don't know how or if this has been addressed. Yeah? Peter Boyle would know, because if anyone has addressed it, it's him. So So the point is that each time, normally, of course, you, if you didn't have this fast pool unit, you would have to go through the bus, you know, there's software overhead and so on, and then go back to the send unit, right, which has a lot of latency associated with it. And in this case, you only pay this latency once instead of, you know, n times along this dimension. And that saves you a lot of time to do the global sum. And we'll see later in the performance figures, you know, how fast this really is. So here are some pictures, and I've brought one off the board, so we can just pass this around. And you don't have to be afraid, this is already broken, so just don't steal it, okay? Just return it, okay? So this is a daughter, so-called daughter board with two chips on it, and then a little bit of Ethernet hardware. There are these PHYs, the physical transceivers, two per chip, and then there's a 4-to-1 hub, so that only one Ethernet signal comes off the board. And then for each chip, you can have up to 2 gigabytes of standard DDR memory. And then you put 32 of such daughter boards on a motherboard, so 64 chips all together. And then you put 8 of those motherboards into a single so-called air-cooled crate. So there are some fans down here that blow air for the machine. And this is the back, and you see the cabling. The black cables are the SCU cables for the physics communications, and the gray cables are Ethernet cables that go to some switch. And this is the power connector, and that's all you need. No, in this case, there is, it's just the room is air-conditioned, right? And there are some fans down here. There is no air conditioning in the machine, right? You just blow air up. Yeah? Just goes through the machine and out at the top. Yeah? Oh, sorry? Let me see. How much was a... This... let me try to remember. So it's if it's... 10, 64, 10. It's less than 10 kilowatts, certainly. Yeah, but yeah, it's a lot less. Yeah, and this is one actually where there is some air conditioning, and this is these are the water cooled crates where you have 16 motherboards, and there is some chilled water that you have to put in here, and there's some. And this is just a box for the Ethernet switches. And this is the back, and this is the back without the cables. So all of this is very simple here. This is where the SCU cables plug in. This is the Ethernet cables, and this is just for the clock, and there's not much more here. And this is one of the machines in Brookhaven. So these are 12,000 nodes, okay? So this is all very compact. Yeah, would easily fit. That's probably from here to here, you know, something like that. So. This one down here?
Yeah.
May not have been delivered on time, I don't know.
It's like a lot.
That's right. I think that's the UK machine. Yeah. This is something when you design a chip. So actually, if you get a board now, it will have a heat sink on the chip, so it's actually quite valuable because you can still see the chip. Yeah. This is something many of you probably haven't seen before. This is when you simulate the chip before you actually make the chip, right? You have access, with the software, you have access to all the signals on the chip, you know, the entire bus traffic, all the interfaces of the CPU, and you can check whether you designed your hardware correctly, right? So there are some, this is a typical bus traffic on this PLB bus, which is the analog of the front side bus, and you have to check that, you know, you follow all the protocols and so on, and it's quite complicated, and there are zillions of signals that you have to worry about. But the good thing, of course, is that you can control them, whereas once you have a chip, you know, you have only a very small number of external pins, and you don't really know what's going on inside. So it's it's very exciting the first time you get the chip, you know, to see whether or not it actually works. And this is sort of the first signal that we looked at now in real hardware, which is, you know, a communication from one node to the next, and there are these high-speed serial links, and they just send bits, right? So you have to find out what the byte boundary is to know where the byte begins, right? And the way you do that is you send so-called training bytes, which are known both to the sender and the receiver, so you can find out where the byte edge is. And in this case, this is a 5A in hex, so it's a 0101 1010, right? And this actually worked as programmed, so that was extremely nice to see in the beginning. Yeah. Now, of course, more sophisticated, you can look at how this actually works over a long period of time. So this is so-called data eye for the physics communication, and you see that when you sample the signal at a rising clock edge, there is no ambiguity whatsoever. So you have very clean signals. Okay, a few words about software. Peter Boyle has written the operating system called QoS, which consists of a number of components. First is the so-called QDaemon. So everything has sort of prefaced by Q. Because if you have a C, in C shell or Bash, you have no command that starts with a Q, right, for some reason. And so all the commands that you take C shell and just add some commands that start with Q. Right. Sorry? I think it's exit. Actually, I think it's exit. Yeah. It's exit or logout or something like that. Yeah. Okay, so QDaemon is the program that runs on the host machine that controls QCDOC. And this is what the user interacts with. So it looks just like a C shell or a TC shell, so that you can do command completion and so on. And this allows you to, you know, download your user program to the machine. And there's lots of diagnostics integrated into this QDaemon. And so what happens when you turn on the machine is that first you download another little program, the so-called boot kernel, via this Ethernet JTAG device to the instruction and data caches, you know, parallel to all the nodes. And that will configure all the devices on the chip. And it will then download the run kernel. Well, actually, no, you yourself are downloading the run kernel. It's not done by the boot kernel. But when you download the run kernel, this boot kernel is kicked out. And then the run kernel takes over, which is really the OS that then runs on the QCDOC node. And this is, of course, a single user, single process run kernel, because you don't want to slow down your calculation by, you know, time scheduling and so on. And the user has access to the communications hardware so that operations can be performed with very low latency. So that was already mentioned by Robert yesterday. The nice thing about using a standard CPU, of course, is that you can use standard compilers. You don't need your own programming language and your own compilers. So GCC and G++ work, and there are more high-performance compilers by IBM, XLC, and XLC++. So all of these work. In principle, one could also compile Fortran code, but no one has bothered to do the Fortran support. So in principle, it can be done, but it involves some amount of work, and it hasn't been a top priority. Then there is this QMP library that Robert explained yesterday for the internode message passing, and Chou-Wu Chang has written this for QCDOC. This is, of course, part of SIDAC. Then the popular codes, CPS is the Columbia Physics System, Milcode and Chroma by Robert, have been ported to QCDOC. Peter has this automatic assembly generator, you know, where you input something in a pseudo language and then specify the characteristics of your cache and so on, and your FPU, and then it will generate optimized assembly code, which is used in the conjugate gradient, of course. Then I admit that I'm not quite sure about this promised MPI port to QCDOC, which was supposed to be done by Robert Bennett at Brookhaven. And maybe you know more about that, but this has been ongoing for a long time. I've never actually seen it work, so I'm not sure what the status of this is, but it's not used anyway by the Lattice QCD code, so yeah. And Robert has talked in detail about SIDAC software yesterday, so I'm not gonna, I don't have to do that today. And then there's a very nice tool called RiskWatch, which sort of the software companion of this Ethernet JTAG interface, where you can really go to your processor, and these are some wristwatch windows, and you can find out exactly what's going on in your processor. You see what kind of code is executed at the moment. You can do an ASM step. You can step through the assembler instructions. You can look at the memory, know exactly what data are at a given address. You can look at all the registers in the CPU, and you know exactly what's going on in your machine. So that is a very, very nice tool, which connects to these nodes via the Ethernet. Yeah, so you don't need to go and plug in something to a single node. Yeah? You can just sit somewhere on a different continent if you want, right, and connect to node 7,326 or so. Yeah. Okay, now performance figures, all of which have been measured by Peter, and there are three relevant areas to look at: memory, system, network, and then, of course, most importantly, the performance of the application code. So this is some, the effective bandwidth you get from the memory system, the on-chip memory, and the external DDR memory. And that depends a lot on the compiler options you use, whether you give some help to the compiler by putting some macros into your code, and of course, Peter's automatically generated assembler code beats all the other options. That goes without saying. Now the network performance. This is the ping-ping bandwidth. This is similar to the ping-pong bandwidth that Robert explained yesterday, except that you send a lot of packets in one direction and finally get the ACK as a function of the message size. And so these lines here are QCD OC results depending on how many links you're actually using. And I'm not sure actually why he didn't use 12, because after all, we have 12. I see. Okay. Yeah. And this is compared to Ethernet, MariNet, and InfiniBand that Robert explained yesterday. So this is Ethernet, MariNet, InfiniBand. Yeah. And so the asymptotic bandwidth here, of course, is also high. But what we really care about is smaller messages, if you have small local volumes. And there you see that there's a huge advantage for QCD OC, for the QCD OC network over these very expensive commercial networks. And so if you do a single link ping pong, that's the thing that Robert explained yesterday, there's a certain maximum bandwidth, of course, and you get half of this maximum already with very small messages, 32 bytes. So this is really the edge that QCD OC has over everything, all the other architectures. And this is the latency to the total time it takes to send a message of this size here, if you just use one link, and then of course if you communicate the same amount of data on with using more links, then this effectively becomes very small. And notice the scale here. This is on the order of 1 microseconds. Not I think it's if you send the same amount of data using many wires, not one, right? Then, so the latency here is not the time. So it depends on how you define latency. It's really the time until everything gets there, not when the first bit gets there or first byte, but everything. Right? So you're winning. You have a lot more bandwidth then. So it includes, of course, this is the startup time plus a component that includes bandwidth. So I like to define latency as the time it takes for the first bit to get there. But in this case, he defined it to be the total time. So, it's the same. It's the same clock. Yeah, it's all synchronous. So whatever you clock the chip, and this is the CPU frequency and the wire frequency. So they're identical. They're locked. Yeah. And the memory is 1/3 of that. So the external DDR would run at 140 in this case, or 280, depending on how you count with DDR. Yeah. Okay, this is the global sum. So I've already explained this hardware acceleration, and so there's a rough, you know, formula that Peter came up with how long this global sum takes, depending on the number of processors and the dimensionality, how you wire it up. Yeah? And this is given here as the number of processors and the number of dimensions that you're using. And at this, when he did these benchmarks, he only had, you know, 1,000 nodes, so he couldn't go faster. Yeah, but you know, it's pretty clear how it scales, and he just hasn't gotten around to doing a benchmark on the bigger machine yet. Okay, so. I don't know. What could that be? I don't know, actually. I can probably figure it out, but not in 10 seconds. So, yeah. And so, in this case, this is also at 420. If you have 1,000 nodes, you can do a global sum over the entire machine in 16 microseconds. And Robert mentioned some something on the order of this for just a single single hop, yeah, using on PC clusters. Yeah. So this is clearly where QCD has a great advantage. Yeah. And now the application code. So there are a number of popular fermion actions. Again, this was not yet on the big machines because they weren't there yet. And this is just the matrix vector multiplication that doesn't involve the global sum. And here, this is including the global sum. And you see that depending on the action, you get, you know, so something between 40 and 55%, so 39 and 54%. Yeah, you know, so almost 50% on average. And you don't lose a lot due to the global sum. Yeah, that's the important message
almost
here.
40% on average. I actually think that now that we have a real machine, we ought to be accurate. I mean, huh? The machine got 40% of the success. And that's really big strength.
Sorry?
40%. So the performance of the machine is 40%.
Depends on what you do.
Well,
what the local volume is.
Lower. The is about 40%.
No.
Why?
No, this is on so many nodes, right?
Look at the CG performance. We're not going to use Clover. Okay? So the CG performance that we're going to use, we supported the fourth month through the fourth. It's worth it.
Yeah. Okay? Well, but
so
not by much.
39, 4, yeah. And 42. Okay? That's not averaging 50.
Okay. Well, it depends on what you do. If you say you don't want to do Clover, you know.
We're not doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you, yeah, but here he plots, I mean, he computes it for, you know, with, I mean, so.
Well, I'm looking at PG performance, 39,
40, 42. I mean, we're just arguing semantics, right? I mean, it's just semantics, right?
Semantics. I mean, when we compare different architectures, we could all.
Yeah, okay. I don't know by how much how we should delay lunch because of this discussion. Right? Oh. This is the scalability, so the percentage of peak you get sustained performance as a function of the number of processors, which typically, you know, for clusters or these, you know, not so, for these underpowered commercial computers, typically then levels off. And here you see that it's still a perfect straight line up to 1,000, and it will go on as almost a perfect. So there's very little degradation due to the global sum, even up to 10,000. And you see here, this is the ideal. This is what you would get if you would use the external memory, right? So if you have a large local volume, it doesn't fit into the embedded memory. So you're on this curve, and then at some point you fit into the embedded memory, and then you're on that curve. Yeah, so the, these lines? No, it's not a fit, it's not a fit to these points, if that's what you're asking. It's the theory.
Yeah.
You cannot do faster than that because of the performance of this DDR. So if your points would be above that line, you're lying, or you know this. I mean, you can be on the line or below the line.
Careful,
Okay, so this was using a local volume that you know you would get if you had 32 to the fourth on a 16K machine. Yeah? So this is actually not cheating because you're on a smaller machine, but it's using the same local volume. So that's why it's reasonable to expect that you get 4 to 5 teraflops on any of these three big machines sustained. Okay, the summary I've already given you, so the current clock speed, this is the only new information, or maybe not new, that the current clock speed is 420 instead of the 500 that we were originally aiming at. It's still not 100% clear what the limiting factor is. The communications, the FPU, now it points more towards the FPU, which was not under our control. This is IBM, right? So there is still some hope to improve this, especially on smaller machines. Because typically, you know, run at the speed of the slowest node, right? But at the moment, it's running fairly stably at 420. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah? I see. But Peter did all of this at 420, so maybe that's because the machine became larger and then there was some noise. Yeah. So now let me enter the realm of speculation, what's going to happen in the future, because after all, that's what the conference is about. So clearly, if we wanted to compete with IBM in this general purpose market, we would lose. I mean, there's just, we are just a few people, and you know, they can kill us, you know, whenever they want to, right? So they're already working on BlueGNP, the petaflop machine. There are some ideas for the successor to that, BlueGNQ. I'm not allowed to tell anything, any details, because that's confidential, but especially not about the schedule, because then if it would slip, they would look bad. So, but certainly this machine will exist and will do a petaflop. Okay? It's the next letter in the alphabet. What would the motivation be to compete in the general purpose market?
Very fast and giving you around 41,000. So the question for the future is why do we continue to wait? Because we think that we.
Okay, I've written this here. So if we can get a factor of 10 over these machines in price performance. But they're not interested in special purpose machines, right? Because they wouldn't be able to sell them to many customers at high profits, right? So the only way, the only motivation for us to continue in this game is, so if we can achieve a factor of 10 over these machines, right? Then that's a good argument to the funding agencies, right? So if we can't do that, we should just give up and go home and buy clusters also, yeah? Yeah? That depends very much on the customer. The machine, of course, is the same, but well, it depends on who buys it at what price, right? So Al told me last Friday that they have so many orders now that they can't really keep up, and so they're increasing the price, and it depends a lot. So Thomas Lippert in Jülich, he's getting their first test racks, right? So they're being dismantled now, shipped to Jülich. He gets them at a very cheap price, right? It's sort of the second-hand hardware, so it depends on who's buying it. And they don't really quote any numbers. I was at a workshop in Jülich where there were all these IBM guys, and I've asked many of them, right? And they don't say anything. And Gian throws around numbers that I don't know, where they are in this wide range of possibilities.
I can say I think there are machines which are going to get about a factor of 2 worse than the TCFC.
So you're really talking about the good transfer of
that. You just said the arm cream.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's not a product, and you can't look up the price from the book.
Right.
So that's the problem here. But I think it's about a factor of 2 worse. That's the code for the reason it's not really true. And I said, everybody works on the site as the code for the TCFC.
One should also remember that without QCDOC, BlueGene-L probably wouldn't have happened that way.
Right.
Yeah. So this is something that people tend to forget, right? But yeah. Okay. Let's. Okay. So. Okay. That's right. Yeah. So clearly, clusters, of course, are, you know, we've seen the numbers yesterday. So clusters, of course, are a very good alternative, except that, you know, on the scale of 10 or 20,000 nodes, you know, they're not scaling yet. Okay. So we actually had a meeting last Friday at Columbia with Norman and Rob and Elgara and Peter and I, and discussed a number of possibilities. And unfortunately, I'm sworn to secrecy, you know, because we all signed confidential disclosure agreements with IBM and so on. And so lots of the inside information we get, we cannot. Sorry?
And the Norman.
And so, so there are a number of possibilities. One is, again, to make a custom ASIC just like QCDOC, taking advantage of new technology that is being developed either by IBM or by other companies. Or one could use a commercial chip. This could be a low-power Opteron or some chips made by Broadcom or ClearSpeed and so on. And design, and of course, the chip has to have a high-speed I/O interface. And then you would design a companion ASIC which has your communications hardware on it, and would then you would just design to this standard interface like HyperTransport, for example. No, you have to. I mean, you would interface this standard commercial chip via HyperTransport with your companion ASIC, and then you have to drive the cables, of course, using another protocol, not HyperTransport. No. You have a companion ASIC. So this is the chip which has a HyperTransport interface, right? Then you design your ASIC, and then you do your multidimensional network, you know, using some other technology, not HyperTransport, right? So this would be your node. So similar to QCDSP. And you take advantage of this standard interface. You're not driving the long wires using HyperTransport. Okay. The problem is that, you know, the NRE, the non-recurring engineering costs, so the startup costs that you have to pay if you want to make an ASIC, are going through the roof. So this is becoming extremely expensive. I mean, you mentioned yesterday that this new chip factory costs $1 billion also, right? And so you take a very high risk, you know, if you go custom. We already took a high risk with QCDOC and we succeeded, but the risk is going to be a lot higher next time around. So these are factors one has to take into account. And that, of course, motivates us to look at these commercial chips. And let me say a few more words about the cell. Like Robert did yesterday, this is sort of how it looks like. And this is what they call a full custom ASIC. This is an ASIC where the standard design tools that we were using don't work anymore. So they really hand-tune every single transistor on that chip. You know? And so we couldn't even dream about doing something like this, you know, with our manpower. You know? It's completely impossible. And so there's a 440 power PC here, level 2 shared level 2 cache. Then there are 8 floating point units, so-called synergetic processing elements, SPE. So there's some element interconnect bus, so some bus. Then this is the memory interface, the RAM bus XDR memory interface, and the so-called flex IO RAM bus interface. And let me just. So this was designed by a team of 300 engineers. So again, no way to compete with that kind of manpower. And this is actually made by IBM according to specifications by Sony, right? So this is not something IBM cooked up. It was really dictated by Sony for their video games, right? So the first chips are going to be made in this 0.09 mu process, and then they're going to switch to a finer process. It apparently has already been proven to run at 4 gigahertz, but the power consumption is not negligible at that frequency. If one wanted to build a big machine, one could think about running this at half the frequency, and this would go down a lot, right? Because power, I think, goes quadratically with frequency. So this, I've already explained this. So each FPU has some private memory that no one else can access. And each one of these FPUs can do 4 fuse multiply adds per cycle. So if you, so this is 8 times 4 times 2, because it's multiply adds, so you get a peak performance of 256 gigaflops at this frequency in single position. Unfortunately, so there's also double precision capability, but it's a factor of 10 or so slower. There's this, I haven't been able to figure out how big the L2 is, but I just looked this morning, so probably the information is somewhere on the web. And a huge amount of bandwidth, of course, as Robert mentioned yesterday already. So there, the big question, of course, is whether the memory subsystem can keep up with this and keep the FPUs fed. And you already mentioned this yesterday, and Robert's estimate was that you can probably get 10 gigaflops sustained because, you know, for latticity applications. And then how to program this thing. This is very non-trivial, and that's why. So at IBM, they have a blue gene team and they have a cell team, and they are completely disconnected. And the blue gene guys could have gone with the cell probably if they had wanted to, but they thought that it was too difficult to program, so for the general purpose market. Yeah? But we in latticity, I mean, someone like Peter Boyle can, I'm sure, can program this sort of thing, right? So, yeah. And with this, I'd like to close. Thanks. Yeah.